Professor Robinson's class, Civil Procedure course, 26 November, podcast number 1, room number 238.
Okay, everybody, quiet down. Looks like we have a lot of people here, notwithstanding the Thanksgiving. Quiet. We have a lot to cover tonight. Not fooling around. First of all, housekeeping. I ran out of attendance sheets, so I'm going to have you sign next to the last one. Okay. Now, I've decided this is what we're going to do. It turns out I got a lot of questions, which is great. And so we got a lot to cover. I'm still not sure about class on Tuesday, although it's very unlikely. What I think I'm going to do is this. Let me stop for a second. I want to come back to that. I got a couple of requests from people to podcast tonight. And, you know, I thought about it. I was back and forth, and I actually sent someone an email today saying I'm not going to podcast it. And the reasons why I don't want to podcast this is, first of all, I didn't want to encourage people not to be here, given that it's, you know, it's a required class, and it is the night before Thanksgiving. But more importantly, and this is much more importantly, this is going to be a review session, but it's not a substitute for the hours and hours and hours we spent this semester talking about this stuff. So I didn't want to put any sort of special, even though it's closer to the exam and I know it's something you're all anxious about, I didn't want to put any special emphasis on this class versus any others which I haven't podcasted. I don't want you guys poring over this stuff. You know, you're torturing yourself as it is. What are you going to listen to it 5 times, you know, over the Thanksgiving break? But then I thought about it, and I said, you know, if they want to torture themselves, let them torture themselves. And you know, there might be a few people here, you know, even though it's not an excused absence, I understand it is the eve before Thanksgiving if they had to travel back out of state, and I want to give them the opportunity to hear this. So I'm going to make a podcast available, and you guys can do whatever you want with it. This is not a warranty. If this battery dies or this thing blows up on me and it's not available, then it's a bonus that you're not getting. But I'm intending to podcast this. As for Tuesday, it's likely that the class is going to be canceled. What I'm going to do is, between now and then, you could email me more questions, because I know you're going to have some over Thanksgiving break. And what I'm going to do is, I'm not going to have a class, assuming that it's canceled. But what I'm going to do in lieu of a class is podcast much a similar type of format to what I'm doing now, which is basically reading through your emails and answering them. And it may not be an hour long, but whatever it is, I'm going to podcast it, and that will be the substitute for the class. Also on that podcast, I'm not going to start with provisional remedies tonight, because I want to get through the questions. If I get to the end of the questions, which I may not, but if I get to the end, and there's a lot of time left, maybe I'll do provisional remedies, but if I'm too tired, I might just put that on the podcast too. And you could listen to it. It could do it in probably 5 minutes on a podcast, or it would take 20 minutes to do in class with, you know, with questions and answers. So without further ado, there's no method to this madness. If I'm not going to stop for questions, because I have way too many here, and the people that took the time to email me are going to get preference. If you have follow-up questions, email them to me, and I'll either cover them in the class on Tuesday, if we have a class, or if not, I'll cover them in a podcast. If for some reason I can't do a podcast after Tuesday, because, you know, the people that do the podcast aren't around, because I don't think that'll be the case, then I will respond in writing, and that will be in lieu of a podcast. I'll tell you what all the questions were that I received from today's class and respond in writing. But I assume that I'll be able to do a podcast. The podcast, for the makeup class on Tuesday, I don't know if that'll be done on Wednesday or Thursday. Okay, so there's a lot of information, but all that information is going to be on this podcast. So if you miss something, you'll have it, okay? All right, let's start. Let's start with personal jurisdiction. Can you decipher the differences between general jurisdiction over the person And here's the other thing. The other reason I'm doing the podcast is don't type frantically trying to get the question. If you hear a question that you think you have, that you also share, then write it down. If you know the answer, don't, you know, dictate this whole thing. You don't have to. It'll be on podcast. Listen. You know, listen to see what you're interested in and write those things down. But don't try to dictate this. You don't have to. And that's another reason why I'm podcasting this. Okay, can you decipher the differences between general jurisdiction over the person and specific jurisdiction over the person? Alright, general jurisdiction is based on systematic and continuous contacts. And so, you know, we know the easy cases, like if for an individual who's domiciled or a corporation where their principal place of business is or where they're incorporated. You might also have general jurisdiction if the contacts are continuous and systematic, even outside that. For example, a corporation who does a lot of business in a state, even if they're not incorporated there or have their principal place of business there, you might get general jurisdiction. Specific jurisdiction is the SHU analysis, the minimum contacts analysis. Now, you could have both general and specific jurisdiction. They're not mutually exclusive, but you need to have at least one. And if you don't have general or specific, then you need one of the traditional bases, like tag jurisdiction, or consent, or waiver, or one of those. Okay? Next question. I got two questions like this. My study group is currently split on where Schaefer took the concept of in rem and quasi in rem. While quasi in rem is gone, what happened to in rem? Good question. Let's see, there was another one. During the ruling in Schaefer, does the ruling in Schaefer apply to both in rem and quasi in rem? Or is physical property in a state and related to the claim still a valid argument for jurisdiction? Now, in these questions, the questions actually aren't worded correctly. This may create further confusion, but I've explained this a couple of times, and maybe it's more complicated than it needs to be. But in theory, quasi in rem and in rem still exist. Both of them still exist, in theory. But what Schaefer says is that in order for the state to be able to issue a binding judgment over the person who owns the property or is claiming a right in the property, you have to have minimum contacts. Now, in the case of in rem, you're going to have minimum contacts because in rem means it's litigation over the property. You're litigating a dispute about the property, and so you're going to have the contacts necessary for minimum contacts. So when we say that, you know, minimum in rem is still alive, that's essentially what they're saying, is that if you really have an issue about the property, minimum contacts is going to be satisfied. Quasi in rem is more difficult, though, because quasi in rem used to be invoked to get jurisdiction over the property where you couldn't get jurisdiction over the person. And the property had nothing to do with the litigation. And so in cases of quasi in rem, you're not going to be able to get, the court's not going to be able to issue a binding judgment over the property unless you also have minimum contacts over the person, okay, who owns the property. So while in theory quasi in rem still exists, but people talk about it as being dead because as a practical matter, there's no need to get quasi in rem. Because if you're going to have to go out and get minimum contacts against the defendant anyway, then why limit yourself to the value of the property for your recovery? Okay, because quasi in rem, when it used to exist, meant that if you won, you can recover up to the value of the property. That's it. Whereas if you had the traditional types of personal jurisdiction, you could go after the property, you could go after the defendant's bank account, you could go after his house in another state, because you have power over the person. So since you need to get power over the person anyway, there's no point in having quasi in rem anymore. So I hope that answers the questions. If it doesn't or created more confusion, then just email me and we'll talk more about it. You might not even need to include this in the review, but I'm asking anyhow. A plaintiff files a complaint and receives a summons to serve on a defendant to notify them of the case. This is a question of the waiver of service process under Rule 4D. Okay, why would a plaintiff want to waive service? ask the question, would it be specifically because serving the defendant might prove too difficult or costly? Yes, that's right. Also, why would a defendant agree to the waiver? Do they receive more time to file an answer as a result? Yes, they do. I looked through the federal rules, but can't seem to figure it out. Look at Rule 4D, and you'll figure it out. Okay? Next. My understanding of Rule 5 Volkswagen is that the opinion says that jurisdiction cannot be founded solely on the existence of a chattel in the state. That's pretty close. It's good. Is this the same as the stream of commerce argument? And then it goes on with a very good understanding and sort of personal jurisdiction. But the confusion here, and I won't get into the rest of the email because I don't need to. The difference between Worldwide Volkswagen and stream of commerce cases is this. Worldwide Volkswagen had to do with a finished product, a car. And they're saying if a finished product goes into a state, that alone is not enough for minimum contacts because there's no purposeful availment there. Stream of commerce deals with a different situation. It's when you put a part, like a piece of a valve, for example, of a motorcycle wheel, or some piece that's going to make up a larger finished product into the stream of commerce. What are the contacts necessary then? And that's what Asahi deals with. And as you know, there was a split among the justices, 4-4. Some say that you need these plus, but four of them that said you need putting into the stream of commerce plus some other contacts to satisfy it. I hope that answers that question, but if not, please follow up with me. Next question, am I doing the right thing? Yeah. Yes. Is it possible to have, this is a question about long-arm statutes, which I think was the only one I got. Is it possible to have a party meet the contacts needed for the more restrictive long-arm statute, like Florida's in Gibbons case, and then fail the constitutional minimum contacts test? I don't necessarily see how once you pass the more restrictive test, you would get a different result regarding jurisdiction under the minimum contacts test. Okay, good questions. Well, if you pass, if you satisfy the requirements of a more restrictive long-arm statute, in other words, if the statute requires something more than minimum contacts, then of course you're necessarily going to satisfy the constitutional requirement. Okay? The problem occurs when the state statute requires something less than minimum contacts or something less than what would otherwise constitute general jurisdiction. In those situations, you might satisfy the long-arm statute because it's more lenient than the constitutional requirements of due process, and that's when you have a problem. Okay? During the course of the semester, this is a question, a general question, really. I have heard the term jurisdiction used many different times and in many different contexts, I think. I was just wondering if you could go over the different meanings. Additionally, there are many different types of jurisdiction, personal, general, diversity, subject matter, etc., etc. So, and I know as it relates to personal jurisdictions, there are sub-jurisdictions of that, right? Tag jurisdiction, for example. Can you just sort of sort this all out? Well, what does jurisdiction mean? Jurisdiction means power, authority. Okay? There's two general top headings that you should be thinking about. There's personal jurisdiction, which is power over the person, and there's subject matter jurisdiction, which is power over the claim. Okay, now under the heading of personal jurisdiction are general jurisdiction, specific jurisdiction, and tag jurisdiction. Those are all ways to get power over the person. And under subject matter jurisdiction, you have things like diversity jurisdiction, federal question jurisdiction, and removal jurisdiction. So hopefully that helps sorts out all the different types of jurisdiction and under which headings and to what they relate. How are we doing on time? Well, we're rocking. I'm going fast, but I think I hope I'm not going too fast. If it looks like I'm in good shape, I'll slow down. But I want to make sure I get to as many as I can. This is a question about notice. Is substituted service for state court only? My notes make reference to Mullane, so I'm not sure if substituted service is allowed in lieu of the service rules of Federal Civil Procedure 4. All right. Let's talk about service just real quick. We didn't spend a lot of time on it because we were spending a lot of time on other things. Personal service means you hand it. This is one of the other questions I got in a different email. Personal service means you hand it to somebody. You deliver it. You put it in their hand. Substituted service means anything else. You know, you leave it with someone of suitable age. You mail it to the door. You mail it to them. Okay? Now, substituted service is okay in federal court, provided that it meets the requirements of Rule 4. And you got to look at Rule 4 and see what it allows. It has to meet the requirements of Rule 4 and Mullane's constitutional test. Okay, so this is another example of where you have to meet a statute, or in this case a rule, but you always have to meet the Constitution, which sort of lingers in the background. The rules and the statutes tend to be more restrictive, but you always have to meet both. Now, substituted service is okay in state court, provided that you satisfy the requirements under the state statutes. So if, let's say we're suing in a state court. Well, then you have to look to the state statutes to serve as a process. If you satisfy them, you're fine. But again, you always have to satisfy the constitutional requirements. That's true whether you're in service in state court or service in federal court. I'm confused about waiver, and this is a question about collateral attacks. I'm confused about waiver and collateral attacks. Specifically, I do not understand how collateral attacks are available if personal jurisdiction is not waived or decided in the original action. Well, here's how it works. You listen, you get one chance to challenge personal jurisdiction, okay? So if you show up and you waive it because your lawyer or you forget to raise it as a defense or don't think to, or you don't want to because you're perfectly happy to litigate this in wherever the action was brought, that's it. Or if you make a defense, you say there's no personal jurisdiction over me, and the court disagrees, you could appeal that to the appellate court, but you can't bring you can't challenge it then in the collateral action. That's giving you a second bite of the apple. Okay? I mean, conceptually, I mean, you're getting a second bite on appeal, but I'm distinguishing that type of second bite from the second bite of litigating this in a completely separate action, a second action. So a collateral attack or a collateral action is a second action. You have one where the case is going on and someone's asserting personal jurisdiction over you. If you don't show up and you don't do anything and you ignore it, then you can challenge that in a second action. But the caveat is that the only thing you'll be able to challenge is personal jurisdiction. Okay, you're not going to be able, if you don't show up, what's going to happen? A default judgment is going to be entered against you on the merits. They're going to say that you breached the contract. They're going to say that you were negligent. Okay, if you bring a collateral attack, the only thing you're going to be able to argue is that you don't have personal jurisdiction over me. You're not going to be able to say I didn't breach the contract or I wasn't negligent. If you win, the court agrees you're right, there was no personal jurisdiction over you in the first instance, then you can challenge it. But if you lose the personal jurisdiction challenge, then the default is going to stand. That's why determining whether or not to collaterally attack something or simply to show up and defend it in the original action is a strategic decision that you have to think about carefully before deciding just to ignore something. This is it. Okay, if minimum contacts or reasonableness are lacking or do not balance one another to form a strong argument, will the presence, and I think I can slow down a little bit, will the presence of foreseeability and or purposeful availment fill in the gap to form a better argument for personal jurisdiction? What is the ideal combination of factors to establish defendant's inability to sue in a particular forum? Okay, well, the ideal combination of factors would be, you know, having both specific jurisdiction and general jurisdiction. Like, the defendant is domiciled in the jurisdiction, and everything happens in the jurisdiction giving rise to the case. That's a great case scenario, because you're going to have specific and general jurisdiction. And now when you're going to have it, it's going to be an easy case of it. Now, minimum contacts and personal availment are not different tests. All right? The minimum contacts test says that certain minimum contacts are going to qualify to give rise to specific jurisdiction. And it's that certain minimum contact is the qualifier. Not every single contact with the state counts for its minimum contact. The ones that count, or maybe I should say in the negative, ones that were not purposely directed at the forum are not going to count. And ones that are purposely directed at the forum are going to count. So purposeful availment is one of the criteria you use to determine whether or not there's minimum contact. It's not a substitute for minimum contact itself. Now, foreseeability is a little trickier. It's not really clear exactly where foreseeability works its way in. Certainly, it can be used to support a finding of reasonableness. Remember, you need to have minimum contact and you have to have reasonableness. And so whether or not something is foreseeable, whether or not it's foreseeable that someone will be hailed into the court is a factor that would go towards reasonableness. But foreseeability also is a factor for minimum contacts, because it sort of works in a similar way as purposeful availment. So well, what do you do on a test? I would stick with just sort of the pure minimum contacts, purposeful availment analysis, and the reasonableness analysis, and foreseeability, if it fits somewhere, fits more neatly into, I think, the reasonableness analysis. In a case where there are multiple defendants that are joined, if one collaterally attacks for lack of jurisdiction and wins, okay, back to collateral attack, sorry to group these together. In a case where there are multiple defendants, if one collaterally attacks for lack of jurisdiction and wins, will the remaining defendants remain in the pre-collateral attack forum? The answer is yes. Like removal, must all defendants agree to collaterally attack? The answer is no. There's a couple of caveats, though. First, the plaintiff may want to keep everyone together. So if one of the defendants is collaterally attacking, the plaintiff may choose to just bring the case somewhere else, assuming that there's personal jurisdiction over the other defendants where the person that collaterally attacks, where there's personal jurisdiction over the person who's collaterally attacking. That's number one. And that's a strategic decision. However, there's also legal consideration, which we're not going to cover until next semester, but I'll mention it. If the defendant is quote-unquote an indispensable party, in other words, the defendant who's collaterally attacking says, I don't want to go there, there's no personal jurisdiction, if that defendant is indispensable to the case, and we'll talk about next semester what that means, then that could be a basis for dismissal for the defendants in the original action. They're saying, essentially, we can't litigate this without the other guy. And so if there really is no personal jurisdiction over the other guy, then this case has to be dismissed against us right now. But we'll talk more about that next semester. All right, that's personal jurisdiction. We're in good shape. Okay. There is a couple of things that I could definitely use a little review on. I understand the basic concepts, blah, blah, blah. Okay, supplemental jurisdiction. This hopefully will give you some comfort. For those of you, you know, you're not alone if you have questions. And if you think that some of these questions are easy, then that's great. But, you know, there wasn't that much overlap of the questions that I received. There was a few subjects where I got overlap. But everybody sort of has different questions about different things. So, which is, I don't know what to make of that, but that's fine. But no one knows everything. How's that for a takeaway? All right, everybody's got questions. There is pendant and ancillary, but there are at times I don't even, that's not even English. Okay. I'm unclear on that specific issue. Listen, you don't need to understand the difference. This is a question of supplemental jurisdiction. You don't need to understand the difference between pendant and ancillary, because those were doctrines which preceded the codification of supplemental jurisdiction in 1367. If you really want to know what pendant and ancillary are, the answers might be in Glannon's. I know it talks about it in the other supplement, Understanding Civil Procedure. There might be some utility in understanding it, because if you understand that, it might help you understand how the statute operates, because those provide the background for the statute. But if you understand how the statute operates, you don't have to dig any deeper. So I'm not going to spend any more time on that. The other question was, the whole outcome, this is an eerie, the whole outcome determinative idea, it's murky. I was hoping you could possibly discuss it. Let's talk, that's one that whoever wrote this, we could talk individually, okay? It's a little too broad, okay? Alright, so here's some more. What's the difference between, we're talking about diversity now, what's the difference between minimum diversity and complete diversity? The difference is one is minimum and one's complete. No, I'm just kidding. Actually, I had a couple of questions on this. Minimum diversity refers to the constitutional requirement, meaning that you need to have at least one party on the P side diverse from at least one party on the D side. That's what minimum diversity means. That's what the Constitution requires. All right? Now, the Supreme Court has said, for purposes of the statute, the diversity jurisdiction statute, that you need complete diversity. Okay, so again, this is the difference between a standard under the Constitution and a standard under the statute, which is more restrictive. Right, now, the statute itself does not call for complete diversity, but the Supreme Court decided to interpret it that way. That's the difference. So the answer is, to have subject matter jurisdiction, you always need to have a statutory basis, and it has to satisfy the Constitution. All right. So, which means that, subject to some exceptions that exist in the alienage context, you need complete diversity, and if you have complete diversity, you're going to satisfy the minimum diversity, necessarily. Okay. Because if everyone's diverse, then you satisfy the requirement that at least one party be diverse from at least one party on the other side. How do you personally serve someone? You put it in their hand. Diversity, citizenship, timing, and burden of proof. So the question is, what's the timing for diversity of citizenship? As I understand the question, it is, when do you look to see when diversity of citizenship is satisfied? The general rule is that when the action is commenced. Okay, so you look to see whether diversity, for purposes of diversity jurisdiction, is satisfied at the time the action is commenced. Now, there's an exception in removal, because for that, you have to look to at the time it's commenced and at the time of removal. And then there's an exception to the exception for removal, which is Caterpillar. Okay. Caterpillar says that in the removal context, which was a different question I had, even though you normally need diversity both at the time it's filed and at the time of removal, Caterpillar says you don't need it at the time of removal if you had diversity prior to the time of judgment. In other words, if after the removal, diversity occurred because one of the parties dropped out, as long as you had diversity at the time that the judgment was entered, then it's going to essentially cure the problem and you're okay. What is the deeming clause? That's a question one of the alien questions. The deeming clause is that provision that makes an LPR a legal permanent resident, a citizen in the state in which he or she is domiciled. And it's called the deeming clause because we're deeming something to be the case even though it's not really the case. Okay. That person's not really a citizen of the state, but we're going to deem that person to be a citizen of the state. When does the clock stop ticking for statute of limitations. When served or when the complaint is filed? Well, the answer to that is that it's determined by the jurisdiction you're in. Okay? Different states have different rules. In the federal system, it's when the complaint is filed. If you're in state court, you have to look to see what the state court rule is. Injunctions. This goes to the amount in controversy. And we talked about there's four different... Let me just frame the issue a little bit. You have to have more than $75,000 to meet the amount of controversy. Injunctions, which we actually talked about last class, are not money judgments. They're telling a defendant to do something or refrain from doing something. So how do you put a dollar amount on that? Is that, you know, if you tell the defendant to do something, is that worth $75,000 and a penny, or is it not? And the courts are split on how to address that situation. One approach is to look to see how much, what is the value owed to the plaintiff? If the defendant does something or refrains from doing something, will that benefit the plaintiff to the sum of $75,000 and a penny or more? That's one approach. Another approach is to look to see how much is it going to cost the defendant to comply. If it's going to cost the defendant more than $75,000 to comply, then it's satisfied. Another approach is to determine the value or cost to the party asserting jurisdiction. So basically, if the plaintiff is asserting jurisdiction, you look to see what the value is, or if the defendant's asserting jurisdiction, like in a removal, then you look to see what the cost of the defendant is in complying. And another approach is that it'll apply any of the above, and as long as $75,000 is met, then we're going to deem the amount of controversy to be satisfied. I got a number of questions. This has to do with aggregation of claims. I got a lot of questions on the notion of undivided interest between plaintiffs. Not a lot. I got maybe three questions on that. But that was one of the questions I actually received three questions on. A lot of these were just one question. It's a little complicated for you to understand, you know, because it's really a property question and you haven't had property yet. Let me give you an example of an undivided interest. Basically, if there's two people suing over a piece of property, and let's say the property is worth $100,000, okay? Each of the plaintiffs has a 50% ownership in the property. Because, whatever, they split it, you know, when they bought it, they each put in whatever, they each own it half. So, technically, you can look at it and say, well, each of them has a claim for $50,000, in which case you don't meet the amount of controversy requirement. But this is sort of an exception. And if there's an undivided interest in one piece of property that they're suing over, and they both have an ownership interest, that's an undivided interest. And therefore, you could sort of aggregate those claims, in a sense. That's what undivided interest means. Okay, so and I got a lot of questions about this one, too. For supplemental jurisdiction, there was a lot of you, understandably, were sort of confused about, under 1367B, about, you know, this restriction against claims by plaintiff against parties that were joined under Rule 14, Rule 19, Rule 20, and 24. Okay? We're going to be, that's an issue of joinder of parties that we're going to be spending a good amount of time next semester on. Right? All you need to understand that 1367 takes away supplemental jurisdiction when it's a diversity case and it's a plaintiff's claim against somebody joined under one of these rules. I don't expect you to understand the circumstances under which someone is joined under those rules, but if this comes up on the exam, I'll tell you. I'll say, you know, the plaintiff wishes to bring a claim against the party joined under Rule 19. Okay, so you know, that's all you would need to know. And we're going to talk in more detail and come back to supplemental jurisdiction just when you thought it was over. We're going to come back to supplemental jurisdiction a bit next semester when we do all this joinder. But that was a good question. These are all good questions. Okay, here's another laundry list of questions. If in a partnership, one partner is not a U.S. citizen, can diversity jurisdiction still be applied, granted all the other requirements are met? Yes, the answer is yes. Assuming there's complete diversity among the other parties. The next question. This is a long one, let's try this. Okay. I'll try to read it slow, it's a little complicated. The difference between arising under jurisdiction when comparing Section 1331 and Article 3 of the Constitution is that under the statute it should be interpreted strictly using the Motley test. That's right. But with Article 3, Section 2, it should be interpreted more broadly. A federal question should be an ingredient. What's the difference between these two interpretations? Do they contradict each other? Which one supersedes? This is another example of the constitutional provision, being bigger and the statutory requirement being more restrictive. So to have federal question jurisdiction, you have to satisfy the more limited Motley arising under test. If you satisfy that test, you have no problem satisfying the constitutional test. So it's not that they're in conflict. One is stricter than the other, and if you meet the first, you'll meet the second. If you meet the statute, you'll necessarily meet the Constitution because the statutory requirement is stricter. Okay. Yeah, I got a few questions about this one too. Let me take this one. We were given a diversity hypo. This is an alienage falling through the cracks situation. We were given a diversity jurisdiction hypo with a New York and Israeli plaintiff and a Canadian defendant in an amount exceeding $75,000. We're told that there's no diversity jurisdiction because it falls through the cracks of 1332A2 and A3. That's true. Understanding that the two aliens do not have diversity jurisdiction when suing each other, that's true too. When two aliens sue each other, there's no jurisdiction under the Constitution or the statute. Here, a citizen of a state is suing an alien, and the alien plaintiff is just an additional party. Why is it there that there's not diversity jurisdiction? How does it fall through the cracks? Well, what they're saying is essentially, you have to look at the statute to understand this. So if you have your statutes, and I got this question from a few people. 1332. If you look at, 1332, subsection H2, says that citizens of a state and citizens or subjects of a foreign state. That's not what we have here. We have citizens of a state, and we have citizens and subjects on both sides. Citizens and subjects of a foreign state on both sides. So it doesn't satisfy the strict requirements of subsection 2. And then it says citizens of different states in which citizens or subjects of a foreign state are additional parties. Well, we don't have that either because we don't have citizens of states on both sides. So if you just read the statutory language, it doesn't satisfy each one. Now, you say, why sort of is a policy matter, why does that make sense? And the question puts it is that isn't it just it says that the alien plaintiff is just an additional party. Well, that's one way to look at it, but the other way to look at it is that the citizen is just the additional tack-on party. And so if the citizen is just a tack on party, what you're really talking about here are two aliens suing each other with the citizen as the tack on party. Maybe that if you allow jurisdiction in those situations, then you could have a situation where two aliens are suing each other and are tacking on a citizen just to get jurisdiction. But that's starting to smell a lot like the constitutional prohibition against two aliens suing each other. Plus, there's no real potential bias against the out-of-stater here. Okay, so that's another policy reason. Because why would the court be biased against the citizen defendant in those circumstances? The only other people in the litigation are non-citizens, so the chance of a judge being biased against a state versus people from other countries is not likely to exist under those circumstances. So the justifications for diversity of jurisdiction also don't exist under that scenario. Next question. Multiple plaintiffs could aggregate claims. That was the same undivided interest question. Okay, that's the same question about you to know all the rule, you know, for the joinder for 1367B. No. Let's say a plaintiff is suing a defendant in federal court over diversity jurisdiction for an amount exceeding $75,000, and the second plaintiff joins the suit and sues the defendant for $50,000. That is another joinder question, so we're going to cover that next semester. This is another question. Just to clarify, the limit of 1367D are only for federal cases that were given federal jurisdiction due to diversity and not pertaining to federal cases that have jurisdiction due to federal question, correct? Yes. Right, but, oh, excuse me, then it goes on, but 1367 should be for both. That's correct. Could you please explain what the statute of limitation means in 1367D? Take a look at 1367D. Again, 1367, just to orient you, these are all supplemental jurisdiction questions. What subsection D says, listen, if you brought a claim that you thought there was supplemental jurisdiction over and it turns out there wasn't, such that the claim gets dismissed. And in the meantime, the statute of limitations has run. We're not going to bar you. We're going to allow you another 30 days to refile that dismissed claim in state court. Okay, we don't want to punish plaintiffs for guessing wrong that their claim should be covered under the supplemental jurisdiction provision. And we're also going to allow the plaintiff to bring the original claim that gave the court jurisdiction 32, just in case the plaintiff wants to keep them together. That's what that provision says. This is a personal jurisdiction question, but it was tacked on. I'll just answer it now. And it basically says... basically, I'm not understanding the tag jurisdiction and why, you know, Schaefer says you need to have minimum contacts for all types of personal jurisdiction. Why is there an exception to tag jurisdiction? And the answer is, well, the court was divided. If you think that there should be a base, if you think you need minimum contacts to support tag jurisdiction, then read Brennan's decision for the reasons why. Scalia thinks that you don't because it's always been that way. You know, we've always allowed jurisdiction to over the person in cases where the jurisdiction where the person was found in the state, and that's essentially based on a principle of reciprocity. You know, if the person is actually in the state taking advantages and the benefits from the state, then under a principle of reciprocity, their presence there is enough. Or maybe it's like a waiver theory. If you come to our state, then you essentially waive any challenges to personal jurisdiction if you happen to be tagged while you're here. If you disagree with that, then it means you agree with the other four justices. That's all. All right, so I think this is another alienage question. I understand that permanent immigrants are considered to be citizens of the state in which they have domicile. What tripped me up was the notion of class breaking them down into immigrants into two groups, non-immigrants like tourists and legal permanent residents, which led to the following question. What is the residence of a tourist since they have no domicile? Does the hotel count or their port of entrance? Their residence is where they're from. You know, if they're just coming to visit, as opposed to someone who's coming to live here, people that are coming as legal permanent residents means that they're coming here indefinitely. They're allowed to come here and work and stay, and maybe they'll have a chance to become citizens. So, very much in theory, their domicile is in America now. That's because they're intending to stay here. By definition, someone who is not a legal permanent resident means that they're only visiting. And so if they're only visiting, then their domicile is their home country. What is the residence of a foreign corporation? They aren't incorporated in the U.S. So the residence of a foreign corporation is where they're incorporated. You know, someone in the country, if a business is incorporated in Sweden, then they're Swedish, that's their domicile. If that's where the principal place of business is, then that's where they are. The deeming clause does not apply, that's the deeming clause, is that provision for legal permanent residence, does not apply to corporations. You can only be a permanent resident here for immigration purposes if you're an individual. We don't grant immigration benefits to corporations. It's just for individuals. Okay, I need a break. But we're doing okay on time. Let's take 10. Thank you. let's carry on. Come on, guys, if you don't want to do it, I don't have to do this. This is for you. Quiet down. Let's carry on with this madness. Let's see. This is another. I got a bunch of alienage questions. This stuff is complicated, but let's do some more of it. Let's see. I don't understand why, in a federal diversity jurisdiction, we give any power to a foreign citizen. Okay. Section 1332(a)(2) says there is diversity between, I think by power they're saying why we're protecting them against bias. I think that's what it's meant there. 1332(a)(2) says there is diversity between a U.S. state and a foreign citizen. How does bringing the claim in federal court eliminate any fairness to the foreign citizen? If the claim is brought in the state or federal court, aren't we still applying that state's law, or at least U.S. law? How does that solve the problem of unfairness to a foreign citizen who is from a country that might have completely different laws? Take that in a couple of steps. Sometimes the only place that a non-citizen can sue is in the defendant's home state, because that's the only place with personal jurisdiction and that's the only place with venue. So, you know, and sometimes we're protecting, in diversity jurisdiction, we're protecting the defendant from being sued out of state, but sometimes we're protecting the plaintiff, who has no choice but to sue in the defendant's state, right? And that would not be fair to the plaintiff, because the bias might be to the plaintiff, too. And so maybe that's the reason, you know, how a foreign citizen might be prejudiced, and why we might provide diversity jurisdiction. And I guess the question is why do we care? That's a good question. To me, it almost seems as though we were just let me just skip that, because that was just a point that was correct. Would there be complete diversity if the two U.S. state parties are diverse, but the two foreign parties are not? For example, you have California and Mexico on one hand, and New York and Mexico on the other hand. All right, so it's a question of, like, how does complete diversity work in the alienage context? And as we talked about, the courts are split on this. The Supreme Court hasn't decided it. If you have, California and Mexico on one side, and New York and Canada on the other side, more courts will say that that's fine. Not all, but more. When you have California and Mexico versus New York and Mexico, you still have some courts saying that's fine, but then you have more courts saying it's not fine because you don't have complete diversity with respect to the two Mexican parties. As I understand it, diversity was traditionally established to avoid prejudice against an out-of-state party. Does this relate primarily to the prejudice of the jury? If so, whether or not a New York plaintiff brings action against a Pennsylvania defendant, why does it matter? Essentially the point, and I got this question from someone else too, why does it matter? Because you're going to have it, whether you're in state court or federal court, you're going to have the same jury pool, essentially. Really, though, what we're protecting against is bias from judges. Now, of course, we like to think that judges are going to be impartial, but at the time of our founding of the country, there was maybe skepticism that they would be. And so, what do the judges do? Let me ask, put it in the negative. What juries do is they find the facts, and certainly you can have prejudices by juries. But of course, diversity jurisdiction doesn't solve that problem, because it's the same jury pool. But what it does is it gives you a federal judge versus a state judge. And a federal judge, since the federal judge works for the country, versus a state judge who might be elected by the people, you might be less likely to get bias from a federal judge than a state judge. So that's the distinction that must be drawn there. What's the rule when two foreign citizens, but one of them is a permanent resident in the U.S.? So this is the Sada case. Remember that tricky little case? Why did that come out the way it did? And it's a good question. The reason was the court looked to the legislative history of the amendment. We're talking about the deeming clause, which deemed legal permanent residents who are still citizens of their foreign country. We're going to deem them to be citizens of the state where they're domiciled. And the reason the court did that is when looking to the legislative history, it determined behind the amendment, it noticed that there were comments that the amendment was intended to limit jurisdiction. Okay, it was intended to limit jurisdiction. It didn't want to have a situation where you had someone in New York suing their next-door neighbor who is an LPR going to federal court because it sort of because the reasons for diversity of jurisdiction didn't exist there. It's a purely local action. Now, in Saada, the situation, what happened, though, was it was a situation which essentially would have created jurisdiction between two non-citizens. It was not what the amendment is targeted to doing. And so you need to, with that understanding, hopefully that clarifies a little bit, you have to reread Saada if you're still confused about it. I think the key to unlocking it is the understanding that the deeming provision was intended to limit jurisdiction, but under the facts of the case, the way the issue came up, it actually created jurisdiction where it previously didn't exist. If you take away the deeming clause and you strip it to its core, what you really had in that case was one alien suing another alien. And that's a problem under the Constitution. And so with all that sort of as a backdrop, that's why the result was reached beside that. What's the difference between, this is another aggregation issue, or the amount of controversy, what's the difference between compulsory counterclaims and permissive counterclaims, and when do they need to meet the amount of controversy? We're going to talk about the difference in detail next semester between permissive and compulsory counterclaims. Compulsory counterclaims, because you have to bring them, that's what, you know, compulsory connotes. You don't have to meet the amount of controversy requirement. But permissive counterclaims are the ones where you don't have to bring them. And so we're going to require the amount of controversy in those situations because the defendant has the option just to file a separate lawsuit. Doesn't have to file in the federal form. So we're not going to take permissive counterclaims under the $75,000 limit. All right, that's subject matter jurisdiction. Venue and transfer. My study group met over the weekend. Okay, venue questions. The venue statute, section 1391(b)(3), states that if venue is not appropriate under B1 or B2, then one can look at judicial districts where any defendant, quote-unquote, may be found. Can you please clarify what this means? Well, it's not entirely clear what that means, but let me give you some guidance. If you look at A3, it talks about any judicial district where there's personal jurisdiction. Is that the right language? Personal jurisdiction? Hold on. Let me get it right. Yes. If you look at A3, it talks about any judicial district in which any defendant is subject to personal jurisdiction, whereas in B3 it says any district where the defendant may be found. Probably there's just a drafting error there, or at least arguably there was just a drafting error there, and they intended it to say the same thing. But they didn't, so now what? Well, if you have personal jurisdiction, then the may be found required to be B3 will be met. But maybe it's a little bit broader, because maybe it applies to the type of tag jurisdiction that Scalia talked about, and depending on how that will evolve, if you agree with the four justices that require tag plus, then maybe this may be found could apply to Scalia's notion of tag jurisdiction, and maybe therefore maybe broader than a traditional conception of personal jurisdiction. That's the best I can tell you on that. The venue statute 1391 deals with venue for corporate defendants. This is actually a good question, but it's a little complicated. If you get lost in this one, don't worry about it. But try to follow along. Okay, 1391 deals with venue for corporate defendants, as a fallback, and you'll have to read 1391 here, and it's the last sentence of it. It says that if there's no such district, the corporation shall be deemed to reside in the district within which it has the most significant contacts. Would that not make it subject to personal jurisdiction? Which does not make sense, since this is the fallback clause and personal jurisdiction is not applicable. It's a very good question. Let me give you an example. You could have a situation where there's personal jurisdiction over a corporation in the state, okay? And this provision deals with states in which there's more than one district. Okay, some states only have one district. This deals with a situation of when there's more than one. You could have, let's give an example where there's three districts. If you combine all the contacts with all three districts, you have enough for personal jurisdiction. Okay, but if you look at the contacts with any one district, you don't have enough for personal jurisdiction. So in those circumstances, you go with the district where there's the most amount. So conceptually, it's possible. I don't know how many times that actually comes up, but that's how it's conceptually possible. Transfer question. For transfer cases, this is a really technical question. Do we need to know 1406 and 1631? Yes, you do. But there's not much to know there. 1406 is a transfer to correct venue, and 1631 is a transfer to correct an absence of personal jurisdiction. The requirements are slightly different. You'll have to take a look at the rules. If you have any more questions about them, then you can email me. But they're pretty straightforward. This is a diversity question. During the study session, okay, that's today. Can you go over 1332D? No, I can't. 1332D is these CAFA, the Class Action Fairness Act, and it's not going to be on the test. The only reason I brought it up in class was to give you an example of Congress passing a statute requiring something less than complete diversity, and how that's still okay, or at least arguably still okay, under the Constitution's requirement, which only requires minimal diversity. But the specifics of 1332D is well beyond what we covered this semester, and you don't need to know that. What? Okay. That's okay. All right. When we look to 1391A3 or B3 as a last resort, when exactly does it? This is a venue question. Remember, A3 and B3 you only look to if you don't have any venue under A1, B1, or A2, or B2. And the person is looking for an example. These are these are rare cases where you don't have any venue under A1, or A2, or B1, or B2, depending on if it's a diversity case or a federal question case. But generally, when it involves foreign actions or foreign parties, then you start getting into a situation where you might not have venue under A1, A2, B1, or B2. If you're looking for an example, take a look at Dickey, which was one of the cases we read. Now, that case was a little tricky, and why it was in the textbook is because it involved a combination of domestic and foreign parties, and that's not why I'm directing you there. For example, look to see the circumstances under which the court found there was venue under B3 with respect to the foreign parties to give you an example of when B3 would come into play. Okay. Regarding Dickey, here's another one. Is the holding only applicable to situations involving a LPR, a legal permanent resident defendant, and a U.S. citizen plaintiff? Now, I think the author of this email is getting Sanda and Dickey mixed up. If Dickey doesn't involve an LPR defendant, a legal permanent resident defendant, it involves a foreign defendant, which is different. Remember, a legal permanent residents are talking about individuals that are here living permanently, legally. Whereas the key just involved a foreign corporation that was doing business here legally, but it wasn't an immigration issue. I just explained what the key was. And so if you have any more questions about that, you can email me. All right. I'm running out of steam here, guys. I'm doing my best. Please explain the whole connection between Swift, Erie Guarantee, Bird, Hannah, and Semtex. I don't know if we're going to be able to squeeze that in. You're going to have to do better than that. Next question. So people are finding comfort in that question. Obviously the author, I don't mean to, obviously it's anonymous, but if the author of that question really doesn't have a clue, then come talk to me. But before you do that, please look at the supplemental materials, please go over the notes, because we spent a lot of time on it. If you really don't understand, you don't even know how to ask the question about it, and it's not to be critical, it means that you have a problem and you should come talk to me. If there is no federal law on point in conflict with state law, do we go directly to step two of Hannah? The reason why I wanted to focus on this question is because it's not clear to me what the author is, whether the author said what they meant to say. So it says, if there is no federal law on point in conflict with state law, do we go directly to step two of Hannah? What's important in the question is that it talks about federal law. That's ambiguous, okay? And one of the points of Hannah and Erie and all that, so hopefully this will go to the previous question, is that Hannah deals with when there's a federal rule, okay? Federal rules to be distinguished from federal practices. Federal practices are just things courts are doing. Example is a federal practice is how do you calculate the amount of controversy when there's an injunction. Okay, there's no rule as to that. It's just what the federal courts are doing. It's a practice. They're doing the best they can, and they're making up a rule about it. And it's not codified in the federal rules of federal procedure, and it's not codified in any statute. So what Hannah did was it basically took the whole Erie analysis and it put it to the side in cases where there is a federal rule or statute on point. And in cases where you're just talking about a conflict between a federal practice or a state practice, then the whole Erie line of cases comes in. Okay. So if you meant to say if there's no federal rule on point, then you go to step two, the answer is yes. But if you said if there's no federal practice on point, then the question is just not phrased correctly. All right, next question. I know you said in class that the Supreme Court has not elaborated on how. Well, this reminds me. It says, I know you said in class that the SC has not elaborated. I guess it's the Supreme Court. Has not elaborated on how to apply the rules of Hannah. So let me just stop there. So on the exam, you're going to want to do abbreviations. Oh, gosh. That's fine. I don't really want you to, because it's going to be annoying. I know it's going to be annoying. So try to spell it out. It's going to total take you another minute, to spell out the words. If you actually must abbreviate, then please, make them obvious. Maybe you could say the first time spell it out and then say from now on. If you're just talking about like plaintiff and defendant, you could use the little pi sign and defendant or P&D, that's fine. But for like federal question, don't say federal question mark. That's going to be really annoying. That's going to be really annoying. Because I'm going to like stop. And I'm like, oh, that's just the middle of the sentence. Anyway, just use your judgment. I'm the one grading the exams, and it's going to, when you use abbreviations, I personally don't like them. So I'm not going to grade it against you, but, keep me happy. So use your judgment about it. All right, so back to the question. I know you said in class that the SC has not elaborated on how to apply the rules of Hannah, but I am still unsettled on the twin aims of Erie. I'm having trouble understanding how form shopping and the inequitable administration of the law are two distinct ideas. I am too. I read it as saying that form shopping could lead to the inequitable administration of the law. I read that like that too. What exactly does inequitable administration mean if it's distinct from form shopping? It's a great question. There's conceptually, in cases where you have a situation of form shopping, then I think there is a connection. You know, the form shopping, the ability to form shop is what can lead to the inequitable administration of the laws. Okay? And so there is some overlap there. But conceptually, you could have a situation where a plaintiff is not forum shopping because they're not trying to get a benefit in any purposeful way. But the effect would be the inequitable administration of the law, and all the types of fairness we talked about that would fall under that prong. So that's why I suppose there is a distinction, at least conceptually. A little bit hard-pressed to think of examples of where you would not have form shopping, but you'd have inequitable administration of the laws. But they are conceptually different things. And when the court uses terms like inequitable administration of the law, it just calls out for what are they talking about here? To get a sense of what it means, you have to look back to some of the older cases. You have to read Erie, and you have to take a look at Hannah in some detail, because it eventually it said it uses the term inequitable administration of the law, but that follows a discussion of a summary of what it thought Erie said, and you could get some guidance from looking at the decision. You might want to read the full decision, because maybe the one in the text is not enough for you to get a full appreciation. So read the full Hannah decision, read the full Erie decision, and perhaps you'll have a better understanding of what those terms are and how one might apply in one situation but not both of them. Good question, though. So I'm just going to summarize here the Semtec question. Semtec was a very, very difficult case. I think sort of the crescendo of the Erie problem section of this semester is Hannah. I mean, Hannah's sort of the benchmark for how to apply this stuff. And then we've had some cases since then, Gasparini, and there's a couple that are referenced in the table. And then we have Semtec. Semtec's an important case because it's the last word by the Supreme Court on this issue. And it also shows how the threat of a Rules Enabling Act problem, even though it didn't actually find a Rules Enabling Act problem, but the threat of a Rules Enabling Act problem led it to interpret a rule in a certain way. But the question, more specifically, that I got here, which is sort of the part three of Semtec, in the real version, but also it's included in your textbook, is how does the decision in Semtec ultimately prevent forum shopping? And the answer is, it's a little complicated, like everything about the case, but because Rule 41 didn't apply, the court had to choose between a federal practice and the state law with respect to claim preclusion. Now, why would the federal courts have a say in claim preclusion? Well, remember that what was at issue was the effect of a federal judgment. So, my judgment, I get to say what the effect of it is in terms of your ability to bring a subsequent action based on the same subject matter. That's why the federal court arguably had a say in the matter, the federal court's judgment. And what the court says is, as a matter of policy, so we get to make the law. It's a federal judgment. We get to make the law. Okay, that much is pretty clear. But as a matter of policy, we choose to apply the state law in which we sit. We're choosing to apply, the federal court will apply the California law. And the way that avoids forum shopping is that under those circumstances, a party cannot go to the federal forum for the purposes of getting a more advantageous claim preclusion rule in the event that there's a later dismissal. So if you're in California, you're going to have the same benefits of a dismissal in state court as you will have in federal court. I'm not sure I can explain it any better than that, but it's pretty much what was going on in that case. And then, okay, that was two. Okay, all right. Now what's left? Oh, that's it. Good. Boy. All right, let's do... I'm probably going to regret this, but let's just do this. Let's get this over with. I'm just kidding. This is fun stuff. So we're going to finish up on remedies because we have enough time. We were talking last class about injunctive relief. We were talking about relief generally. I'm not going to go through everything again, but we ended on injunctive relief. And again, that's a court ordering a defendant to do something or refrain from doing something. And you have these general requirements. The harm must be immediate, the harm must be irreparable, and the injunction must be susceptible to sort of limits. It can't be too broad, because if it's too broad, then you're not giving enough guidance to the defendant on how to behave. Let's talk about provisional remedies. What's this? Okay, so... First of all, before we answer these questions, what are provisional remedies? And what purpose do they serve? Let's get back to our normal... I'm tired of talking. What are provisional remedies and what purpose do they serve? We got this contingency over here, but I'm going to go with Kristen on this one. Why does our system have these? Right, so basically provisional remedies recognizes the delay that's inherent in our litigation in this country. And it may be too late to get the relief you're looking for. Now the form of the provisional remedy, it's going to be an injunction, essentially. You're going to be asking for the court to require the defendant to do something or not do something until the litigation sorts itself out. Because if you wait until the end, it might be too late. Now, the provisional remedies gives rise to two questions. We're going to be focusing really on the first one. How should a court decide whether to grant temporary relief when all the information is not available? Remember, this is happening at the onset of a litigation, before discovery, which we'll talk about discovery, but before much is known about anything. If there's not a jury that's going to determine whether or not to give provisional relief. So, put it in practical terms, you have a plaintiff who sued a defendant and is now marching into court and essentially asking for some relief now, immediately, before there's discovery. There's not even a jury yet. We're so far from that. And the judge is going to have to decide whether or not to require whether to grant this preliminary relief or not. And so how are we going to do that? The second issue is, when does the curtailment of the ordinary procedures, right, because this is a sort of a special expedited procedure, cross the line in depriving a defendant of his constitutional due process rights? Remember, so a defendant has the opportunity to be heard. But if the plaintiff is getting relief at the outset of the litigation before discovery, at what point is the defendant losing his constitutional right to be heard? And so these are sort of the issues that surround provisional remedies. Let's talk about William Inglis and Son Baking Company. Now, just quickly on the facts, there's a small banker is alleging that a conglomerate is cutting prices below cost, driving out of business.
series of a series of antitrust violations under state and federal law, and it's plaintiff requests a preliminary injunction against the allegedly unlawful pricing, basically asking the court to preclude the defendants from engaging in this pricing scheme. And so, first question is, what's all the rush? What's the rush? Yes, either one of you.
You don't want to say that he's charging less than the monopolizing industry for the other guys out of business, but the Congress gets to court, he may be the only person taking advantage.
Right. Well, factually, it's important to understand that it's a group of defendants, it's a conglomerate of defendants. But, yeah, the risk here, or what's the rush, is that this small little baker may be out of business by the time we resolve all this. And so the whole point of the litigation will be for nothing. Because the plaintiff won't even exist anymore. And so at that point, what's the point of having the defendants, you know, fix their pricing scheme, because the harm will have already been done. Now the court announces a general, this is one general test, and let's go through this because this is a common one. The plaintiff will suffer irreparable injury. We talked about irreparable injury last time. It's irreparable injury is a legal conclusion that you put on, it's a label you put on it after you sort of look at all the circumstances. But generally, and certainly for purposes of now, we could say irreparable injury is one where, you know, money just won't do. I mean, conceptually, money will always, either conceptually money will never do or money will always do. I mean, you could always put a, you know, some will say you could always put a price tag on it. You know, so if he goes out of business and he goes bankrupt, so what? I'll give you $50 billion. Is that okay? Yeah. I mean, you could put a price tag on it. You know, he may come back and say, no, it's my livelihood. But generally, if money damages won't do, then it's irreparable injury. And I'll say that in the normal case, if all this guy is losing is some profits, if he's making, you know, 10% profits instead of 20% profits, but his business is doing fine, then that's not really irreparable injury, because he could just get whatever his lost profits are after the conclusion of the case. But when somebody is facing the complete termination of their business, such that they're bankrupt, then that starts looking a lot more, and the courts have recognized that as an irreparable injury. So you see, it's sort of a spectrum, and it's not so easy to tell, but in the end, that's what that's the flexibility of irreparable. When does something become irreparable? Generally, if you're looking at bankruptcy, it's irreparable. If you're looking at something less than bankruptcy, it's generally not. The second requirement is that the plaintiff will probably prevail on the merits. Why do you think we're going to require that? Why are we going to require the plaintiff to probably prevail on the merits? You had your hand up, Max. Go ahead.
If you file a frivolous claim that would lose on the merits and you ask for an injunction, you're asking for an injunction to be granted where there shouldn't be one. You could ask basically anything.
Right, so who are we? Right, well, there's the possibility of abuse in a frivolous case. This is beyond a frivolous case. I mean, because it says they probably will prevail on the merits. All right, so who are we protecting here? Right, so we're protecting the defendant here. If the defendant is going to be required to do something or refrain from doing something, and he's not getting his full day in court, then we're going to at least make plaintiff establish to the judge early on that there's a good chance of succeeding here on whatever evidence the plaintiff can bring before the judge that early in the case. Of course, the defendant might also make arguments that the plaintiff will not prevail. And it's not only factual questions. There might be legal issues that might prevent the plaintiff from prevailing, or there might be legal issues which make it clear that the plaintiff will prevail. So it could be factual or it could be legal, but in either case, at the end of the day, the plaintiff has to make a probable showing of success. The third requirement is a balancing of equities tipping in the plaintiff's favor. And, you know, we don't want to harm the defendant to the point where the defendant is going to turn around and ask for an injunction against the plaintiff. All right, so if what the plaintiff is asking for is going to harm the defendant more than the plaintiff is being harmed now, this is not a bar, but it's sort of a balancing. So you have to look to see who's going to be hurt more, the plaintiff if we don't give the injunction, or the defendant if we do, and it's a balancing test. And finally, the granting of the injunction has to be in the public interest. And it's not exactly clear. I mean, this notion of the public interest is a little bit vague, but I think we could flesh it out. If you're the plaintiff in this case, what do you argue to say that the injunction is in the public interest? What's the argument you make, Kunal? Right, so you would argue that the price to, that it's, we're trying to enforce laws, antitrust laws here, which will result in the lower price to the consumer. But if you're the defendant, what's your argument for the public interest? Yes, Kristen.
That by forcing the defendant to raise prices, that
right. So that's the other public interest. It's going to cost consumers more, and we're talking about bread here, people. You know, poor people need bread. I mean, that's the staple of people's diet. So if you're going to make raise the prices of bread, that's not in the public interest. So, and then there's no right or wrong answer there, but that's what the court's going to have to figure out is which side has the better of it. It's another balancing analysis. Now, what did the district court do in this case? Did it grant or deny the preliminary injunction? Grant or deny? David? It denied. Why? Okay, so they didn't think that there would that the plaintiff would probably prevail on the merits. Now, the appellate court says that gives the standard by which it's going to review the district court's determination. This is important. Under what circumstances is an appellate court going to reverse a district court when the district court makes a ruling on a preliminary remedy? Did you guys catch that? Right. So Marion's right. Abuse of discretion, essentially. Also, if there's a legal error. Or abuse of discretion. So understand what that means. It means that these standards of review are sort of the lens that the court looks to see what the district court has done. And there's different sort of lenses the court could look through. The court could just take a fresh look at it, meaning de novo, we talked about that, or it could be deferential. And so what the court's doing here is being deferential. It's saying that unless there's been abuse of discretion, you know, reasonable minds can differ, and the district court came out one way, well, we're not going to second-guess that. That's fine. The exception, if there's a legal error, because the district court applied the wrong legal rule to the test, or made a legal error in determining, you know, there's a question of law, and the district court got the legal question wrong, that's something the court will look at without giving deference. But for factual issues and things of that nature, or on questions about how to balance these things, the appellate court is going to be deferential. So did the district court find an abuse of discretion in... did the circuit court find an abuse of discretion here? Donna? No. So what happened? Why? But ultimately the case gets remanded. Why? Okay, so there's an alternative test. So this is one approach for determining whether to grant a preliminary injunction. But the Ninth Circuit noted an alternative approach taken by other circuit courts. Okay, this is another example. Okay, there's no federal rule on the standard or the test to be applied for when to give a preliminary injunction. So the circuit courts are sort of left to their own devices to try to figure it out. Now, the Supreme Court may come along and resolve this one day and say, no, in cases involving preliminary injunctions, this is the test you apply. But until they do that, the circuit courts are disagreeing. And so what the approach by the Second Circuit is that the moving party must demonstrate either a combination of success and the possibility of irreparable harm. Or, if they can't show that, serious questions are raised and the balance of hardships tips decisively in the plaintiff's favor. And you can think about the relationship between these. So what this, under this approach, you don't have to show a probability of success. If what's implicated here are serious questions, you know, questions of public policy or serious questions of law, and the balance of hardships is really in the plaintiff's favor decisively, meaning that if we deny this, the plaintiff is going to be severely harmed, whereas if we grant it, the defendant's only going to be marginally harmed, then under this approach, you can also grant an injunction. And so the problem in this case is that the district court didn't consider whether or not this alternative approach would be met. Now, under the facts as the district court already found, this would not be satisfied. But it's an either-or test, so maybe the question is this test satisfied? And that was what the case was remanded for. Now, finally, getting away from this case and more talking more generally, what if the plaintiff is granted the preliminary injunction? Okay, if the plaintiff is granted the preliminary injunction, how do the rules protect the defendant? If the plaintiff is granted a preliminary injunction, how do the rules protect the defendant, David? Right. So the plaintiff is generally required to post a bond, and it's up to the district court how much to set the bond for. So essentially, you're saying, all right, plaintiff, you want the defendant to stop fixing or stop lowering its prices, then you have to put some reasonable amount in to protect the defendant if you lose all the profits that the defendant has lost in the meantime. It doesn't have to be mathematical, so the court could try to figure out mathematically what the perfect amount would be to satisfy the defendant, but it doesn't have to be, but sometimes it is, and sometimes the court is just trying to keep the plaintiff honest. You know, the requirement of a bond is to deter frivolous requests for preliminary injunctions. It also is to protect defendants against the fact that it's not having a full day in court. All right, I can see by your faces that most of you are as tired as I am. We only have a couple minutes left anyway. So any questions about this? Good. And so how we're going to proceed is, first of all, everybody enjoy your Thanksgiving. I know you're going to be studying, but try to enjoy it as much as you can. Also, I will be in touch with you about Tuesday, but for now, you should proceed on the assumption we're not having class, and in the meantime, you should email me questions, and I will do a review session either on Tuesday or by podcast of the nature I did today. All right. See ya.